Chapter 12. We went the long way back to Ayaya, avoiding Scylla. 11 days it took. The sky bent its arc over us, clear and bright. I stared into the blinding waves, the white flaring sun. No one disturbed me. The men averted their gazes when I passed, and I saw them cast a rope I had touched into the waves. I could not blame them. They lived on Knossos, and knew too much of witchery already. When we landed on Ayaya, they dutifully carried the loom up through the woods and set it before my hearth. They led up the 8 sheep. I offered them wine and a meal, but of course they did not accept. They hurried back to their ship, strained at their oars, eager to vanish over the horizon. I watched until the moment they winked out like a snuffed flame. The lion glared from my threshold. She lashed her tail as if to say, "That had better be the last of that." "I think it will be," I said. After Knossos's sunny, outflung pavilions, my house was snug as a burrow. I walked its neat rooms, feeling the silence, the stillness, the scuff of no feet but my own. I put my hand to every surface, every cupboard and cup. They were all where they had been, as they would ever be. I went out into my garden. I weeded the same weeds that always grew, and planted the herbs I had gathered on Dicte. They looked strange away from their moonlit hollows, crowded in among my glossy, bright beds. Their hum seemed fainter, their colors faded. I had not considered that perhaps their powers could not survive transplanting. In the years I had lived on Ayaya, I had never chafed at my constraint. After my father's halls, the island seemed to me the wildest, most giddy freedom. Its shores, its peaks, all of them yawned out to the horizon, filled up with magic. But looking at those fragile blooms, for the first time I felt the true weight of my exile. If they died, I could harvest no more. I would never walk again the humming slopes of Dicte. I could not draw water from its silver pool. All those places Hermes had told me of. Araby, Assur, Egypt. They were lost forever. "You will never leave," my sister had said. In defiance, I threw myself into my old life. I did what I liked, the moment that I thought of it. I sang upon the beaches, rearranged my garden. I called the pigs and scratched their bristled backs, brushed the sheep, and summoned wolves to lie panting on my floor. The lion rolled her yellow eyes at them, but she behaved herself. For it was my law that all my animals bear each other. Every night, I went out to dig my herbs and roots. I did whatever spells came to mind, just to feel the pleasure of them knitting in my hands. In the morning, I cut flowers for my kitchen. In the evenings, after dinner, I set myself before Daedalus's loom. It took me some time to understand it, for it was like no loom I had ever known in the halls of the gods. There was a seat, and the weft was drawn down rather than up. If my grandmother had seen, she would have offered her sea snake for it. The cloth it produced was finer than her best. Daedalus had guessed well that I would like the whole business of it. The simplicity and skill at once, the smell of the wood, the shush of the shuttle, the satisfying way weft stacked upon weft. It was a little like spell work, I thought, for your hands must be busy and your mind sharp and free. Yet my favorite part was not the loom at all, but the making of the dyes. I went hunting for the best colors, madder root and saffron, the scarlet kermes bug and the wine dark murex from the sea, and alum powder to hold them fast in the wool. I squeezed them, pounded, soaked them in great bubbling pots until the stinking liquids foamed up bright as flowers, crimson and crocus yellow, and the deep purple that princes wear. If I had had Athena's skill, I could have woven a great tapestry of Iris, goddess of the rainbow, flinging down her colors from the sky. But I was not Athena. I was happy with simple scarfs, with cloaks and blankets that lay like jewels upon my chairs. I draped my lion in one and called her the Queen of Phoenicia. She sat, turning her head this way and that, as if to show off how the purple made her fur shine gold. "You will never see Phoenicia." I rose from my stool and made myself walk the island, admiring the changes every hour brought, the water striders skimming over the ponds, The stones rolled green and smooth by river currents. The bees flying low, freighted with pollen. The bays were full of lashing fish, the seeds broke from their pods. My dittany, my lilies from Crete, they thrived after all. See, I said to my sister. It was Daedalus who answered. A golden cage is still a cage. Spring passed into summer, and summer into fragrant autumn. There were mists now in the morning, and sometimes storms at night. Winter would come soon with its own beauty, the green hellebore leaves shining amid the brown, and the cypresses tall and black against the metal sky. It was not ever truly cold, not as Mount Dictys' peak, but I was glad for my new cloaks as I climbed the rocks and stood among the winds. Yet, no matter what beauties I sought, what pleasures I found, my sister's words followed me, taunting, worming deep in my bones and blood. You are wrong about witchcraft, I told her. It does not come from hate. I made my first spell for love of Glaucus. I could hear her mink voice as if she stood before me. Yet it was in defiance of our father, in defiance of all those who slighted you and would keep you from your desires. I had seen the look in my father's eyes when he knew at last what I was. He was thinking he should have snuffed me in my crib. Just so. Look how they stopped our mother's womb. Have you not noticed how easily she twists father and our aunts? I had noticed it. It seemed to go beyond beauty, beyond whatever bed tricks she might know. She's clever. Clever? Pasiphae laughed. You always underestimated her. I would not be surprised if she has witch blood too. We do not get our charms from Helios. I had wondered that myself. You are sorry now you scorned her. You spent every day licking father's feet, hoping he would set her aside. I paced the rocks. I had walked the earth for 100 generations, yet I was still a child to myself. Rage and grief, thwarted desire, lust, self-pity, these are emotions gods know well. But guilt and shame, remorse, ambivalence, those are foreign countries to our kind, which must be learned stone by stone. I could not stop thinking of my sister's face, that blank shock when I told her I would never be like her. What had she hoped for? That we would send messages back and forth in seabirds' mouths? That we would share spells, fight the gods? That we might be, in our way, sisters at last? I tried to imagine it, our heads bent together over herbs, her laugh as she devised some cleverness. I wished then, oh, a dozen impossible things, that I had known sooner what she was, that we had grown up somewhere other than those glittering halls. I could have blunted her poisons, drawn her from her abuses, taught her how to gather the best herbs. Ha, she said, I will take no lessons from fools like you. You are weak and blind, and it is worse because you choose it. You'll be sorry in the end. It was always easier when she was hateful. I am not weak, and I will never be sorry not to be like you. Do you hear? There was no answer, of course. Only the air, eating my words. Hermes returned. I no longer thought that he had conspired with Pasiphae. It was only his nature to vaunt his knowledge and laugh at what others did not know. He lounged in my silver chair. So how did you like Crete? I heard you had some excitement. I gave him food and wine and took him to my bed that night. He was handsome as ever, keen and playful in our couplings. But a distaste rose in me now when I looked at him. One moment I would be laughing, and the next his jests turned sour in my throat. When his hands reached for me, I felt a strange dislocation. They were perfect and unscarred. My ambivalence, of course, only encouraged him. Any challenge was a game, and any game a pleasure. If I had loved him, he would have been gone, yet my revulsion brought him back and back. He pressed hard to wrap me up, bringing gifts and news, unfolding the whole tale of the Minotaur to me, without my asking. After I had sailed away, he said, Minos and Pasiphae's eldest, Androgeus, had visited the mainland and been killed near Athens. By then, the people of Crete were restive at having to lose their sons and daughters every harvest and were threatening revolt. Minos seized his opportunity. He demanded, as payment for his son, that the Athenian king send 7 youths and 7 maids to feed the monster, or else Crete's mighty navy would bring war. The frightened king agreed, and one of the youths chosen was his own child, Theseus. This prince was the mortal I had seen in the mountain pool. But my vision had not told me all. He might have died, if not for the princess Ariadne. She fell in love with him, and to save his life smuggled him a sword and taught him the way through the labyrinth, which she had learned from Daedalus himself. Yet when he came out from that maze, with his hands covered in the monster's blood, she had wept, and not for joy. "I heard," Hermes said, "that she had an unnatural love for the creature. She would go often to its cage and speak softly to it through the bars and offer delicacies from her own table. Once she got too close and its teeth caught her shoulder. She escaped and Daedalus sewed up the wound, but it left a scar at the base of her neck in the shape of a crown." I remembered her face as she said, "My brother." "Was she punished for helping Theseus?" "No, she fled with him after the creature was dead. Theseus would have married her, but my brother decided he wanted her for himself. You know how he loves the ones with light feet. He told Theseus to leave her on an island, and he would come to claim her." I knew which brother he meant. Dionysus, lord of Ivy and the Grape, riotous son of Zeus, whom mortals call Releaser, for he frees them from their cares. At least, I thought, with Dionysus she would dance every night. Hermes shook his head. "He came too late. She had fallen asleep and Artemis killed her." He spoke so casually that for a moment I thought I'd misheard. "What? She's dead?" "I led her to the underworld myself." "That lithe and hopeful girl. For what reason?" "I couldn't get a straight answer out of Artemis. You know how ill-tempered she is. Some incomprehensible slight." He shrugged. My witchcraft was no match against an Olympian, I knew it. But in that moment I wanted to try, to summon up all my charms, to throw my will upon the spirits of the earth, the beasts, the birds, and set them after Artemis until she knew what it was to be truly hunted. "Come," Hermes said. "If you cry every time some mortal dies, you'll drown in a month." "Get out," I said. Icarus, Daedalus, Ariadne, all gone to those dark fields where hands work nothing but air, where feet no more touch the earth. If I had been there, I thought, but what would it have changed? It was true what Hermes said. Every moment mortals died, by shipwreck and sword, by wild beasts and wild men, by illness, neglect, and age. It was their fate, as Prometheus had told me, the story that they all shared. No matter how vivid they were in life, no matter how brilliant, no matter the wonders they made, they came to dust and smoke. Meanwhile, every petty and useless god would go on sucking down the bright air until the stars went dark. Hermes came back, as always. I let him. When he glittered in my hall, my shawls did not feel so narrow. The knowledge of my exile did not weigh so heavy. "Tell me the news," I said. "Tell me of Crete. How did Pasiphae take the Minotaur's death?"
"She went mad, is the rumor. She wears nothing but black now and mourning."
"Don't be a fool. She is only mad if it suits her," I said.
"She is said to have cursed Theseus, and he has plagued and plagued since then. Did you hear how his father died?"
I did not care about Theseus. I wanted to hear of my sister. Hermes must have been laughing as he fed me tale after tale. How she had forbidden Minos from her bed, and her only joy was her youngest daughter, Phaedra. How she was haunting the slopes of Mount Dicte, digging up the whole mountain, searching out new poisons. I hoarded every tidbit like a dragon guards its treasure. I was looking for something, I realized, though I could not say what. Like all good storytellers, Hermes knew to save the best for last. One evening, he told me a trick Pasiphae had played on Minos in the early days of their marriage. Minos used to order any girl he liked to his bedchamber in front of her face. So she cursed him with a spell that turned his seed to snakes and scorpions. Whenever he lay with a woman,
they stung her to death from the inside. I remembered the fight I had heard between them. 100 girls, Pasiphae had said. They would have been serving maidens, slaves, merchants' daughters, anyone whose fathers would not dare raise a fuss against the king. All extinguished for nothing but petty pleasure and revenge. I sent Hermes from me and closed my shutters, as I never did. Anyone would have thought I was casting a great spell, but I reached for no herbs. I felt her weightless joy. The story was so ugly, so outlandish and disgusting, that it felt like a fever breaking. If I was trapped on this island, at least I did not have to share the world with her and all her kind. Hastening by my lion, I said, "It is done. I will think of them no more. I cast them out, and I am finished." The cat pressed her cheek upon her folded paws and kept her eyes upon the floor. So perhaps she knew what I did not. Chapter 13. It was spring, and I was down on the eastern slope, picking early strawberries. The sea winds blew strongly there, and the sweetness of the fruits was always tinged with salt. The pigs began squealing, and I looked up. A ship was making its way towards us through the slanting afternoon light. There was a headwind against it, yet it did not slow or tack. The oarsman drove it straight as a well-sent arrow. My stomach turned over. Hermes had given me no warning, and I could not think what that might mean. The vessel was Mycenaean in style, and bore a figurehead so massive it must have altered the draft of the ship. A pair of black-rimmed eyes smoked on its hull. It caught a strange, faint odor on the wind. I hesitated a moment, then wiped my hands and walked down to the beach. The ship was close to shore by then, its prow casting a shadow like a needle over the waves. I counted some 3 dozen men aboard. Later, of course, there would be 1,000 who claimed they were there, or who invented genealogies to trace their blood back. The greatest heroes of their generation, that crew was called. Bold and unshakable, masters of 100 wild adventures. Certainly they looked the part. Princely and tall, big-shouldered, with rich cloaks and thick hair raised up on the best their kingdoms had to offer. They wore weapons the way most men wear their clothes. No doubt they'd been wrestling boars and slaying giants from their cradles. Yet their faces at the rail were pinched and tense. That smell was stronger now, and there was a heaviness in the air, a dragging weight that seemed to hang from the mast itself. They saw me, yet they made no sound and gave no signs of greeting. The anchor dropped with a splash, and the plank followed. Above, gulls circled, crying. 2 descended, arms touching, heads bowed. A man, broad and muscular, his dark hair lifting in the late breeze. And it surprised me. A woman, tall and wrapped in black, a long veil flowing down behind her. The pair moved towards me gracefully and without hesitation, as if they were expected guests. They knelt at my feet and the woman held her hands up, long-fingered and bare of any adornment. Her veil was arranged so that not one strand of hair showed beneath it. Her chin stayed resolutely down, concealing her face. "Goddess," she said, "witch of Aiaia, we are come to you for aid." Her voice was low but clear, with a musicality to it, as if it were used to singing. "We have fled a great evil, and to escape it we have done great evil. We are tainted." I could feel it. That unwholesome air had thickened, coating everything with an oily heaviness. Miasma, it was called. Pollution. It rose from unpurified crimes, from deeds done against the gods, and from the unsanctified spilling of blood. It had touched me after the Minotaur's birth, until Dictys' waters washed me clean. But this was stronger, a foul, seeping contagion. "Will you help us?" she said.
"Help us, great goddess, we are at your mercy," the man echoed.
It was not magic they asked for, but the oldest rite of our kind. Catharsis. The cleansing by smoke and prayer, water and blood. It was forbidden for me to question them. To demand their transgressions, if transgressions they were. My part was only yes or no. The man did not have his partner's discipline.
When he had spoken, his chin had lifted a little and I had glimpsed his face. He was young, even younger than I had thought, his beard still in patches. His skin was raw from wind and sun, but it glowed with health. He was beautiful, like a god, the poets would say. But it was his mortal determination that struck me most, the brave set of his neck, despite the burdens upon him. "Rise," I said, "and come. I will help you as I can." I led them up the pig trails. His hand clasped her arm solicitously, as if he would steady her, but she never stumbled. If anything, her feet were surer than his, and still she was careful to keep her face down. I brought them inside. They stepped past the chairs and knelt silently upon the floor stones. Daedalus might have carved a lovely statue of them. Humility. I went to the back door, and the pigs ran to me. I put my hand on one, a piglet not half a year old, pure and unspotted. If I were a priest, I would have drugged him so he would not take fright and struggle, marring the ritual. In my hands, he went limp as a sleeping child. I washed him, tied the secret fillets, wove a garland for his neck, and all the while he was quiet, as if he knew and agreed. I set the golden basin on the floor and took up the great bronze knife. I had no altar, but I did not need one. Anywhere I was became my temple. The animal's throat opened easily beneath the blade. He did kick then, but only for a moment. I held him firm until his legs stilled, while the red stream poured into the bowl. I sang the hymns and bathed their hands and faces in sacred water, while fragrant herbs burnt. I felt the heaviness lifting. The air grew clean, and the oily scent faded. They prayed while I carried away the blood to pour over a tree's wrinkled roots. I would butcher the body later and cook it for their meal. "It is done," I told them when I returned. He lifted the hem of my cloak to his lips. "Great goddess." She was the one I was watching. I wanted to see her face, freed at last from its careful custody. She looked up. Her eyes shone bright as torches. She drew off her veil, revealing hair like the sun on Crete's hills. A demigod, she was. That potent mix of human and divinity. And more than that, she was my kin. None had such a golden look except the direct line of Helios. "I am sorry for my deception," she said, "but I could not risk you sending me away, not when I have wished all my life to know you." There was a quality to her that is hard to describe, a fervency, a heat that went to your head. I had expected her to be beautiful, for she walked like a queen of the gods, but it was an odd beauty, not like my mother's or sister's. Each of her features alone was nothing, her nose too sharp, her chin overstrong. Yet together, they made a whole like the heart of a flame. You could not look away. Her eyes were clinging to me as if they would peel me. "You and my father were close as children. I could not know what messages he might have sent you about his wayward daughter. The force in her, the certainty. I should have recognized who she was at first glance, only from the set of her shoulders." "You are Aeetes, child," I said. I searched for the name Hermes had told me. "Medea, is it not? And you are my Aunt Circe." She looked like her father, I thought, that high brow and sharp, unyielding gaze. I said no more, but rose and went into the kitchen. I put plates and bread on a tray, added cheese and olives, goblets and wine. It is law that guests must be fed before the host's curiosity. "Refresh yourselves," I said. "There will be time to make all clear." She served the man first, offering him the most tender morsels, urging bite upon bite. He ate what she gave him hungrily, and when I refilled the tray, he chewed that as well, his hero's jaw working steadily. She ate little. Her eyes were lowered, a secret again. At last the man pushed back his plate. "My name is Jason, heir by rights to the kingdom of Iolcos. My father was a virtuous king, but soft-hearted, and when I was a child, my uncle seized his throne from him. He said he would return it to me when I was grown, if I gave him proof of my worth, a golden fleece kept by a sorcerer in his land of Colchis. I believed that he was a proper prince. He had the trick of speaking like one, rolling words like great boulders, lost in the details of his own legend. I tried to imagine him kneeling before Aetes, among the milk fountains and coiling dragons. My brother would have thought him dull, and arrogant besides.
Lady Hera and Lord Zeus blessed my purpose. They guided me to my ship and helped me gather my comrades.
When we arrived in Colchis, I offered King Aetes fair treasure in payment for the fleece, but he refused. He said I might only have it if I performed a task for him. The yoking of two bulls and the ploughing and sowing of a great field in a single day. I was willing, of course, and accepted at once. Yet
the task was impossible.
Medea's voice slipped between his words, easy as water. A ploy designed to keep him from the fleece. My father had no intention of giving it up, for it is a thing of great story and power. No mortal, however valiant and brave. At this, she turned to Jason, touched her hand to his. Could accomplish those things unaided. Those bulls were my father's own magic, crafted of knife-sharp bronze and breathing fire. Even if Jason yoked them, the seeds he had to sow were another trap. They would become warriors springing up to kill him. Her gaze was fixed passionately on Jason's face. I spoke more to bring her back than anything else.
So you contrived a trick, I said.
Jason did not like that. He was a hero of the great golden age. Trickery was for cowards, men not bull-necked enough to show true courage. Medea spoke quickly over his frown.
My love would have refused all help, she said. But I insisted, for I could not bear to see him in danger.
It softened him. This was a more pleasing tale, the princess swooning at his feet, forswearing her cruel father to be with him, coming to him at night in secret, that face of hers the only light. Who could say no? But her face was hidden now. Her voice was low, aimed at her own clasped hands.
I have some small skill in those crafts you and my father know. I made a simple draft that would protect Jason's skin from the bull's fire.
Now that I knew who she was, such meekness looked absurd on her, like a great eagle trying to hunch down to fit inside a sparrow's nest. Simple, she called that draft. I had never imagined a mortal might perform any magic, let alone such a powerful charm. But Jason was speaking again, rolling out more boulders, yoking the bulls, ploughing and seeding the field. When the warriors sprang up, he said, he knew the secret for subduing them which Medea had told him. He must throw a rock among them, and in their rage they would attack each other. So he did, yet Aetes still did not yield the fleece. He said Jason must first defeat the deathless dragon that guarded it. Medea mixed another draught and put the worm to sleep. He ran for his ship with the treasure, and Medea as well. His honor could never permit him to abandon an innocent girl to such a wicked tyrant. In his mind, he was already telling the tale to his court, to wide-eyed nobles and fainting maidens. He did not thank Medea for her aid. He scarcely looked at her, as if a demigoddess saving him at every turn was only his due. She must have sensed my displeasure, for she spoke. He is honorable indeed, for he married me upon the ship that very night, even with my father's forces in pursuit. When he has his throne again, in Iolcos, I will be his queen. Was it my imagination, or did Jason's light fade a little at that? There was a silence.
What of the blood I wash from your hands? I said.
Yes, she said softly. I come to it. My father was enraged. He set out after us, his witchcraft drawing the winds to his sail, and by morning he was very close. I knew my spells were no match for his. Our ship, however blessed, could not outrun him. One hope only I had. My younger brother, whom I had taken with us. He was my father's heir, and I had thought to exchange him as a hostage for our safety. But when I saw my father at his prow, shouting curses across the water, I knew it would not work. The killing rage was plain on his face. He would be satisfied with nothing but our ruin. He spoke spells in the air. He lifted his staff to bring them down upon our heads. I felt a great fear run through me, not for myself, but for blameless Jason and his crew. She looked at Jason, but his face was turned to the fire. At that moment, I cannot describe it. A madness came over me. I seized Jason and commanded him to kill my brother. Then I cut the body into pieces and threw them into the waves. Wild as my father was, I knew he must stop to give him a proper burial. When I woke from my fit, the seas were empty. I thought it had been a dream until I saw my hands covered in my brother's blood. She held them out to me as if in proof. They were clean. I had cleaned them. Jason's skin had gone grey as raw lead. Husband, she said. He started, though she had not spoken loudly. Your wine cup is dry. May I fill it for you? She rose, moving with the goblet to the brimming bowl. Jason did not watch, and I would not have noticed if I were not a witch myself.
The pinch of powder that she dropped into the wine, the whispered word.
Here, my love, she said. Her tone was coaxing as a mother's. He took the wine and drank.
When his head rolled back, and the cup would have fallen from his hands, she caught it. Carefully, she set it upon the table and took her seat again.
You understand, she said. It is too difficult for him. He blames himself.
There was no madness, I said.
No. Her golden eyes pierced mine. Yet some call lovers mad.
If I had known, I would not have done the right.
She nodded. You and most others. Perhaps that is why suppliants may not be questioned. How many of us would be granted pardon if our true hearts were known?
She took off her black cloak and laid it over the chair beside her. Her dress beneath was lapis blue, bound with a thin silver belt. Do you feel no remorse?
I suppose I could weep and rub my eyes to please you, but I choose not to live so falsely. My father would have destroyed the whole ship if I had not acted. My brother was a soldier. He sacrificed himself to win the war.
Except he did not sacrifice himself. You murdered him.
I gave him a draft so he would not suffer. It is better than most men get.
He was your blood.
Her eyes burned, bright as a comet in the night sky. Is one life worth more than another? I have never thought so.
He did not have to die. You could have turned yourself in with the fleece, gone back to your father.
The look that passed over her face, like a comet indeed, when it veers to earth and turns the fields to ash.
I would have been made to watch while my father tore Jason and his crew limb from limb, then been tormented myself.
You will pardon me if I don't call that a choice. She saw the look on my face. You do not believe me.
You have said many things of my brother that I do not recognize.
Let me introduce you then. Do you know what my father's favorite sport is? Men come often to our isle looking to prove themselves against a wicked sorcerer. My father likes to set the captains of the ships loose among his dragons and watch them run. The crew he enslaves, stealing away their minds so they have no more will than stones. To entertain his guests, I have seen my father light a brand and hold it to one of those men's arms. The slave will stand there burning until my father releases him. I have wondered if they are merely empty shells, or if they understand what is being done to them and scream inside. If my father catches me, I will find out, for that is what he will do to me. It was not the voice she had used with Jason, that cloying sweetness. It was not her gleaming self-assurance either. Each word was dark as an axe head, heavy and unrelenting, and my blood drained at every blow.
Surely he would not hurt his own child.
She scoffed. I am no child to him. I was his to dispose of, like his seed warriors or his fire-breathing bulls. Like my mother, whom he dispatched as soon as she bore him an heir. Perhaps it might have been different if I'd had no witchcraft. But by the time I was 10, I could tame the adders from their nests. I could kill lambs with a word and bring them back with another. He punished me for it. He said it made me unmarketable. But in truth, he did not want me taking his secrets to my husband. I heard Pasiphae as if she whispered in my ear. Aeetes has never liked a woman in his life. His greatest wish was to trade me off to some sorcerer god like himself, who would pay with exotic poisons. None could be found except his brother Perseus, so he offered me to him. I say my prayers every night that beast did not want me. He has some goddess of Sumeria he keeps in chains for a wife. I remembered the stories Hermes had told me. Perseus and his palace of corpses. Pasiphae saying, "Do you know how I had to keep him happy?"
"It is strange," I said, the words weak even to my own ears. "Aeetes always hated Perseus."
"Not now. They are closest friends, and when Perseus visits, they talk of nothing but raising the dead and bringing down Olympus."
I felt numb, barren as a winter field. "Does Jason know all this?"
"Of course he does not. He mad? Every time he looked at me, he would think of poisons and burning skin. A man wants a wife like new grass, fresh and green."
Had she not seen Jason flinch? Or did she not want to see? "He shrinks from you already."
She stood, her dress bright as a cresting wave. "My father pursues us still. We must leave at once and drive on to Iolcus. They have an army not even he can stand against, for the goddess Hera fights with them. He will be forced to turn back. Then Jason will be king and I queen at his side."
Her face was incandescent. She spoke each word as if it were a stone she built her future with. Yet for the first time, she seemed to me a creature clinging to a precipice, desperate, its claws already slipping. She was young, younger than Glaucus when I had first met him. I looked at Jason, drugged, his mouth hanging open.
"You are sure of his regard?
You suggest he does not love me?" Her voice sharpened in an instant. "He is still half a child, and full mortal besides. He cannot understand your history, nor your witchcraft."
"He need not understand them. We are married now, and I will give him heirs, and he will forget all this like a fever dream. I will be his good wife, and we will prosper."
I touched my fingers to her arm. Her skin was cool, as if she had been walking a long time in the wind.
"Niece, I fear you do not see all clearly. Your welcome in Iolcos may not be what you imagine."
She drew her arm away, frowning.
"What do you mean? Why would it not be? I'm a princess, worthy of Jason."
"You are a foreigner." I could see it, suddenly, as plain as if it were painted before me. The fractious nobles waiting at home for Jason's return, each jockeying to match their daughter with the new-made hero and claim a piece of his glory. Medea would be the one thing they would agree upon. "They will resent you. Worse, they will suspect you, for you are the daughter of a sorcerer and a witch in your own right. You have lived only in Colchis. You cannot know how Pharmakeia is feared among mortals. They will seek to undermine you at every turn. It will not matter that you help Jason. They will push that aside or else use it against you as proof of your unnaturalness."
She was staring at me, but I did not stop. My words were tumbling out, catching fire as they went.
"You will find no safety there, no peace. Yet still you may be free from your father. I cannot undo his cruelties, but I can ensure that they follow you no further.
He said once that witchcraft cannot be taught. He was wrong. He kept his knowledge from you, but I will give you all I know. When he comes, we will turn him away together."
She was silent, a long moment.
"What of Jason?"
"Let him be a hero.
You are something else."
"What is that?"
In my mind, I saw us already. Our heads bent together over the purple flowers of aconite, the black roots of moly. I would rescue her from her tainted past.
"A witch," I said,
"with unbound power, who need answer to none but herself."
"I see," she said, "like you, a pathetic exile who stinks of her loneliness."
She saw the shock on my face.
"What? Do you think because you surround yourself with cats and pigs, you are deceiving anyone? You do not know me for an afternoon, yet you are scrabbling to keep me. You claim you want to help me, but whom do you really help? Oh, niece, dearest niece, we will be the best of friends and do our magic side by side. I will keep you close and so fill up my childless days."
She curled her lip.
"I will not sentence myself to such a living death."
Restless, I had thought. I was only restless in those days and a little sad, but she had stripped me to my skin, and now I saw myself in her eyes, a bitter, abandoned crone, a spider, scheming to suck out her life. Face stinging, I rose to meet her.
"It is better than being married to Jason. You are blind not to see what a weak reed he is. He flinches from you already, and you're what? 3 days married? What will he do in a year?
He is led by his love for himself.
You were only expedient.
In Iolcus, your position will rest on his goodwill.
How long do you think that will last, when his countrymen come crying that the murder of your brother brings a curse to their land?
Her fists were clenched.
None will learn of my brother's death. I have sworn the crew to silence.
Such a secret cannot be kept. If you were not a child, you would know it. The moment those men are out of earshot, they will start their gossip. In a day, the whole kingdom will know, and they will shake your trembling Jason till he falls.
Great king, it was not your fault the boy died. It was that villainess, that foreign witch. She carved her own kin. What worse evils does she work even now? Cast her out, cleanse the land, and take a better in her place.
Jason would never listen to such slander. I delivered him the fleece. He loves me. She stood fixed in her outrage, bright and defiant. All my hammering had only made her harder. Just so must I have seemed to my grandmother when she said to me, "Those are two different things."
Medea, I said, listen to me. You are young, and Iolcus will make you old. There is no safety for you there.
Every day makes me old, she said. I do not have your years to waste. As for that safety, I do not want it. It is only more chains. Let them come at me if they dare. They will never take Jason from me. I have my powers, and I will use them.
Every time she said his name, a fierce, eagle love flashed in her eyes. She had him in her grip and would clench him till he died.
And if you try to keep me, she said, I will fight you too.
She would, I thought, though I was a god and she a mortal. She would fight the whole world.
Jason stirred. The spell was fading.
Niece, I said, I will not keep you against your will, but if you ever...
No, she said. I want nothing more from you.
She led Jason to the shore. They did not pause to rest or eat. They did not wait for dawn. They drew up the anchor and sailed into the darkness, their path lit only by the veiled moon and the unwavering gold of Medea's eyes. I kept among the trees so she would not see me watching and scorn me for that too. But I need not have bothered. She did not look back. Out on the beach, the sand was cool, and the starlight dappled my skin. The waves were busy washing away their footprints. I closed my eyes and let the breeze move over me, carrying its scents of brine and ocean weed. Overhead, I felt the constellations turning on their distant tracks. I waited there a long time, listening, sending my mind out into the waves. I heard nothing, no sound of oars, no snap of sail, no voices on the wind. But I knew when he came. I opened my eyes. The curve-beaked hull was splitting the waves of my harbor. He stood on its prow, his golden face outlined against the dawning sky. A pleasure rose in me, so old and sharp it felt like pain. My brother. He lifted his hand and the ship stopped, hanging perfectly still in the waves.
Circe! He cried over the water between us. His voice rang the air like struck bronze. My daughter came here.
Yes, I said.
She did.
The satisfaction shone on his face. When he was an infant, his head had seemed to me delicate as glass. I used to trace its bones with my finger while he slept.
I knew she would. She is desperate. She sought to bind me, but she has bound herself. Her fratricide will hang upon her all her days.
I grieve for your son's death, I said.
She will pay for it, he said. Send her out.
My woods had gone quiet behind me. All the animals were still, crouching to the ground. As a child, he had liked to lean his head upon my shoulder and watch the seagulls dip to catch their fish. His laugh had been bright as morning sun.
I met Daedalus, I said.
He frowned.
Daedalus? He has been dead for years. Where is Medea? Give her to me.
She is not here, I said. If I had turned the sea to stone, I do not think he could have been more shocked. His face bloomed with incredulity and rage.
You let her go?
She did not want to stay.
Did not want to? She is a criminal and a traitor. It was your duty to keep her for me.
I had never seen him so angry before. I had never seen him angry at all. Even so, his face was beautiful, like the waves when they lift their storm heads. I could still ask for his forgiveness. It was not too late. I could say she tricked me. I was his foolish sister, who trusted too easily and could not see into the cracks of the world. Then he would come ashore and we might... But my imagination would not finish the thought. Behind him, at their oar benches, sat his men. They stared straight ahead. They had not stirred, not even to brush off a fly or scratch an itch. Their faces were slack and empty, their arms covered in scars and crusted scabs, old burns. I had lost him long ago. The air whipped around us.
Do you hear? He shouted. I should punish you.
No, I said. In Colchis, you may work your will, but this is Aiaia.
A second moment's true surprise on his face. Then his mouth twisted.
You have done nothing. I will have her in the end.
That may be true, but I do not think she will make it easy. She is like you, Aetes, as oak to oak. She must live with that, and so it seems must you. He sneered, then turned and lifted his arm. His sailors moved their joints as one. The oars beat the water and carried him from me. Chapter 14. Outside, the winter rains had begun to fall. My lioness whelped, and her cubs tumbled across the hearth on their clumsy, new-made paws. I could not smile at it. The earth seemed to echo where I walked. Above me, the sky stretched out its empty hands. I waited for Hermes so I might ask him what became of Medea and Jason, but he always seemed to know when I wanted him and stayed away. I tried to weave, but my mind felt needle-pricked. Now that Medea had named my loneliness, it hung from everything, clinging like spiderwebs, unavoidable. I ran along the beach, gasped up and down the forest paths, trying to shake it from me. I sifted and re-sifted my memories of Aetes, all those hours we had leaned against each other. That old, sickening feeling returned. At every moment of my life, I had been a fool. I helped Prometheus, I reminded myself. But it sounded pathetic, even to my ears. How long would I cling to that handful of minutes, trying to cover myself as if with some threadbare blanket? It did not matter what I had done then. Prometheus was on his crag, and I was here. The days moved slowly, dropping like petals from a blown rose. I gripped the cedar loom and made myself breathe its scent. I tried to remember the feel of Daedalus's scars beneath my fingers, but the memories were built of air and blew away. Someone will come, I thought. All the ships in the world, all the men. Someone must. I stared into the horizon until my eyes blurred, hoping for some fishermen, some cargo, even a shipwreck. There was nothing. I pressed my face into my lion's fur. Surely there was some divine trick to make the hours go faster, to let them slip past unseen, to sleep for years so that when I woke again the world would be new. I closed my eyes. Through the window I heard the bees singing in the garden. My lion's tail beat against the stones. An eternity later, when I opened my eyes, the shadows had not even moved. She was standing over me, frowning. Dark-haired, dark-eyed, with round limbs and a head neat as a nightingale's breast. A familiar smell wafted from her skin, rose oil and my grandfather's river. I am come to serve you, she said. I had been drowsing in my chair. I stared up blearily, thinking she must be an apparition, some hallucination of my solitude. What? She wrinkled her nose. Apparently all her humility had been used up in those words.
I am Alce, she said. Is this not Aiaia? Are you not the daughter of Helios?
I am.
I am sentenced to be your servant.
I felt as if I dreamed. Slowly I got to my feet.
Sentenced? By whom?
I have not heard of such a thing.
Speak, what power sent you?
Naiads show their feelings as water shows ripples. However she had told herself this would go, it was not like this.
The great god sent me.
Zeus?
No, she said. My father.
And who is he?
She named some minor river lord in the Peloponnese. I had heard of him, perhaps met him once. But he had never sat in my father's halls.
Why send you to me?
She looked at me as if I were the greatest idiot she had ever met.
You are a daughter of Helios.
How could I have forgotten what it was like among the lesser gods, the desperate clawing for any advantage? Even disgraced, I still had the blood of the sun in my veins, which made me a desirable mistress. Indeed, for such as her father, my disgrace would be encouragement, lowering me enough that he dared to reach up.
Why were you punished?
I fell in love with a mortal, she said. A noble shepherd. My father disapproved, and now I must do a year's penance.
I considered her. Her back was straight, her eyes up. She showed no fear, not of me, not of my wolves and lions, and her father disapproved of her.
Sit, I said. Be welcome.
She sat, but her mouth was puckered as if she sucked an unripe olive. She looked around with distaste. When I offered her food, she turned her head aside like a sulky baby. When I tried to speak to her, she folded her arms and pursed her lips. They only opened to voice her complaints about the smell of the dyes bubbling on the stove, the lion hairs on the rugs, even Daedalus's loom. And for all her protestations about serving, she did not offer to carry a single dish. There is no need to be surprised, I told myself. She is a nymph, which means a dry well.
Go home then, I said. If you're so miserable, I release you from your sentence.
You cannot. The great gods have commanded me. There's nothing you can do to release me. I'm staying a year.
It should have upset her, but she was smirking, preening as if in victory before a crowd. I watched. When she had spoken of the gods exiling her, she had showed no anger and no grief either. She took their authority as natural, irresistible, like the movements of the spheres. But I was a nymph like her, and an exile too. A daughter of a greater father, yes, but with no husband and dirty fingers and oddly dressed hair. It put me in her reach, she reasoned, so I was the one she would fight.
You are being foolish. I am not your enemy, and pulling faces is no real power. They have convinced you.
But even as the words formed in my mouth, I let them go. It would be like Persian to her. She would not understand it, not in 1,000 years. And I was done giving lessons. I leaned forward and spoke the language she understood.
Here is how it will go, Alke. I will not hear you. I will not smell your rose oil or find your hairs about my house. You will feed yourself, care for yourself, and if you cause me a moment's more trouble, I will turn you into a blind worm and drop you in the sea for the fish.
Her smirks were wiped away. She blanched and pressed her fingers to her mouth and fled. After that, she kept to herself as I had ordered. But word had spread among the gods that Aiaia was a good place to send difficult daughters. A dryad arrived who had fled her intended husband. 2 stone-faced Oreads followed, exiled from their mountains. Now, whenever I tried to cast a spell, all I could hear was rattling bracelets. As I worked at the loom, they flashed in and out of the corners of my vision. They whispered and rustled from every corner. There was always someone leaning moon-faced over a pool when I wanted to swim. As I passed, their snickering laughter washed against my heels. I would not live that way again. Not on Aiaia. I went to the clearing and called Hermes. He came, smiling already.
So, how do you like your new handmaids?
I do not, I said. Go to my father and see how they can be taken away. I feared he might object to being sent on an errand, but it was too amusing for him to miss. When he came back, he said,
What did you expect? Your father is delighted. He says it's only right that his high blood is served by lesser divinities. He will encourage more fathers to send their daughters.
No, I said. I will take no more. Tell my father.
Prisoners don't usually dictate their own conditions.
My face stung, but I knew better than to show it.
Tell my father I will do something awful to them if they do not leave. I will turn them into rats.
I can't imagine Zeus would like that. Weren't you already exiled for acts against your kin? You should beware further punishment.
You could speak on my behalf.
Try to persuade him. His black eyes glittered.
I'm afraid I'm only a messenger. Please, I said. I do not want them here, truly. I'm not being funny.
No, he said.
You are not. You're being very dull. Use your imagination. They must be good for something. Take them to your bed.
That is absurd, I said.
They would run screaming.
Nymphs always do, he said. But I'll tell you a secret. They are terrible at getting away. At a feast on Olympus, such a jest would have been followed by a roar of laughter. Hermes waited now, grinning like a goat. But all I felt was a white, cold rage. I am finished with you, I said.
I have been finished a long time.
Let me not see you again. If anything, his grin deepened. He vanished and did not return. It was no obedience. He was finished with me too, for I had committed the unpardonable sin of being dull. I could imagine the stories he was telling of me, humorless, prickly, and smelling of pigs. From time to time, I could sense him just out of sight, finding my nymphs in the hills, sending them back flushed and laughing, giddy from the great Olympian who had shown them favor. He seemed to think that I would go mad with jealousy and loneliness and turn them into rats indeed. 100 years he had been coming to my island, and in all that time he never cared for more than his own entertainment. The nymphs remained. When they finished their terms of service, others arrived to take their place. Sometimes there were 4, sometimes 6 or 7. They trembled when I passed, ducking and calling me mistress, but it meant nothing. I had been put in my place. At a word and a whim from my father, all my vaunted power blew away. Not even my father, any river god, had the right to fill my island, and I could not stop him. The nymphs wafted around me. Their smothered laughter drifted down the halls. At least, I told myself, it was not their brothers who would have bragged and fought and hunted down my wolves. But of course, that was never a real danger. Sons were not punished. I sat at my hearth, watching the stars turn through the window. Cold, I felt. Cold as a garden in winter, gone deep to ground. I did my spells. I sang and worked at my loom and husbanded my animals, but it all felt shrunk to the size of ants. The island had never needed my hand. It prospered on no matter what I did. The sheep multiplied and wandered freely. They ambled over the grass, nudging aside the wolf pups with their blunt faces. My lioness stayed inside by the fire. White fur stained her mouth. Her grandchildren had their own grandchildren, and her haunches trembled when she walked. 100 years at least she must have lived with me, pacing at my side. Her life extended by the close pulse of my divinity. A decade that time had seemed to me. I assumed there would be many more, but one morning I woke to find her cold beside me on the bed. I stared at her unmoving sides, my brain stupid with disbelief. When I shook her, a fly buzzed off. I pried open her stiff jaws and forced herbs down her throat, chanting one spell, then another. Still she lay there, all her golden strength turned dun. Perhaps Aetes could have brought her back, or Medea. I could not. I built the pyre with my own hands. Cedar it was, and yew, and mountain ash that I chopped myself, its white pith spraying where the axe blade struck. I could not lift her, so I made a sledge out of the purple cloth I had used to wind around her neck. I dragged her through my hall, past the stones, worn smooth by the pads of her great paws. I pulled her up to the pyre's top and lit the flames. There was no wind that day, and the flames fed slowly. It took the whole afternoon for her fur to blacken, her long yellow body to burn down to ash. For the first time, the cold underworld of mortals seemed a mercy. At least some part of them lived on. She was utterly lost. I watched until the last flame was gone, then went back inside. A pain was gnawing in my chest. I pressed my hands to it. the hollows and hard bones, I sat before my loom and felt at last like the creature Medea had named me, old and abandoned and alone, spiritless and grey as the rocks themselves. I sang often in those days, for it was the best company I had. That morning it was an old hymn in praise of farming. I liked the shape of it on my lips, the soothing lists of plants and crops, of crofts and coats, herds and flocks, and the stars that wheeled above them. I let the words float in the air as I stirred the boiling pot of dye. I had seen a fox, and wanted to match the colour of her coat. The liquid foamed up, saffron mixed with madder. My nymphs had fled the stink, but I liked it. The sharp stinging in my throat, the watering of my eyes. It was the song that caught their attention, my voice drifting down the trails to the beach. They followed it through the trees and sighted the smoke from my chimney. A man's voice called out. Is anyone there? I remember my shock. Visitors. I turned so quickly the dye splashed and a burning drop fell on my hand. I smeared it away as I hurried to the door. There were 20 of them, wind rough and shiny from sun. Their hands were thickly calloused, their arms puckered with old scars. After so long amid only the smooth sameness of nymphs, each imperfection was a pleasure. The lines around their eyes, the scabs on their legs, the fingers broken off at the knuckle. I drank in their threadbare clothes, their worn faces. These were not heroes, or the crew of a king. They must scrabble for their livelihoods as Glaucus once did, hauling nets, carrying odd cargo, hunting down whatever dinner they could find. I felt a warmth run through me. My fingers itched as if for needle and thread. Here was something torn that I could mend. A man stepped forward. He was tall and grey, his body lean. Many of the men behind him still had their hands on their sword hilts. He was wise. Islands were dangerous places. You met monsters as often as friends. Lady, we are hungry and lost, he said, and hope such a goddess as yourself will help us in our need. I smiled. It felt strange on my face after so long. You are welcome here. You are very welcome. Come in. I shooed the wolves and lions outside. Not all men were as unshakable as Daedalus, and these sailors looked as though they had known shocks enough already. I led them to my tables, then hurried to the kitchen to bring out heaping platters of stewed figs and roasted fish, brine cheese and bread. The men had eyed my pigs on the way in, elbowing each other and whispering loudly their hope that I might kill one. But when the fish and fruits were before them, they were so eager they did not complain, nor even pause to wash their hands or take off their swords. They bolted and shoveled, the grease and wine darkening their beards. I carried more fish, more cheese. Each time I passed, they ducked their heads at me. Lady, mistress, our thanks. I could not stop smiling. The fragility of mortals bred kindness and good grace. They knew how to value friendship and an open hand. If only more of them would come, I thought. I would feed a ship a day, and gladly, 2 ships, 3. Perhaps I would start to feel like myself again. The nymphs peeked in from the kitchen, eyes wide. I hurried over and sent them off before they were noticed. These men were mine, my guests to welcome as I pleased, and I enjoyed seeing to all their comforts myself. I set out fresh water in bowls so they might wash their fingers. A knife fell to the floor and I picked it up. When the captain's cup was dry, I filled it from the brimming bowl. He lifted it to me. Thank you, sweet. Sweet, the word set me back a moment. They had called me goddess before. And so I believed they thought me. But they showed no awe or religious deference, I realized. The title had only been a flattering courtesy for a woman alone. I remembered what Hermes had told me long ago. You sound like a mortal. They won't fear you as they fear the rest of us. And so they did not. In fact, they thought I was the same as they were. I stood there, charmed by the idea. What would my mortal self be? An enterprising herb woman? An independent widow? No, not a widow, for I did not want some grim history. Perhaps I was a priestess, but not to a god. Daedalus once visited this place, I told the man. I keep the shrine of it. He nodded. I was disappointed at how unimpressed he was. As if there were shrines to dead heroes all over. Well, perhaps there were. How would I know? The men's appetites were slowing, and their heads lifted from their plates. I saw them begin to look around, at the silver on the bowls, the golden goblets, the tapestries. My nymphs took such riches as their due, but the men's gazes were bright with wonder, searching out each new marvel. I thought of how I had trunks filled with down pillows enough to make them beds on the floor. When I handed them over, I would say, "These were meant for gods," and their eyes would go wide. "Mistress," it was the leader again, "when would your husband be home? We would toast such fine hospitality." I laughed. "Oh, I do not have a husband." He smiled back. "Of course," he said. "You are too young to be married. Then it is your father we must thank." It was full dark outside, and the room glowed warm and bright. "My father lives far away," I said. I waited for them to ask who he was. "A lamplighter, that would be a good jest," I smiled to myself. "Then perhaps there is some other host we should thank. An uncle, a brother." "If you would thank your host," I said, "thank me. This house is mine alone." At the word, the air changed in the room. I plucked up the wine bowl. "It is empty," I said. "Let me bring you more." I could hear my own breath as I turned. I could feel their 20 bodies filling up the space behind me. In the kitchen, I put a hand to one of my draughts. "You're being silly," I thought. They were surprised to find a woman by herself, that is all. But my fingers were already moving. I took the lid off a jar, mixed its contents into the wine, then added honey and whey to cover the taste. I brought the bowl out. 20 gazes followed me. "Here," I said. "I have kept back the best for last. You must have some, all of you. It comes from the finest vineyard on Crete." They smiled, pleased at such solicitous luxury. I watched every man fill his cup. I watched them drink. By then, each of them must have had a cask in his belly. The platters were empty, licked clean. The men leaned together, speaking low. My voice felt too loud. "Come, I have fed you well. Will you tell me your names?" They looked up. Their eyes darted like ferrets to their leader. He rose, the bench scraping on the stone. "Tell us yours first." There was something in his voice. I almost said it then, the spell word that would send them to sleep. But even after all the years that had passed, there was a piece of me that still only spoke what I was bid. "Circe," I answered. The name meant nothing to them. It dropped to the floor like a stone. The benches scraped again. All the men were rising now, their eyes fixed on me. And still I said nothing. Still I told myself I was wrong. I must be wrong. I had fed them. They had thanked me. They were my guests. The captain stepped towards me. He was taller than I was. Every sinew taut from labor. I thought, what? That I was being foolish. That something else would happen, that I had drunk too much of my own wine, and this was the fear it conjured, that my father would come. My father! I did not want to be a fool, to make a fuss for nothing. I could hear Hermes telling the tale after. "She always was a hysteric." The captain was close now. I could feel the heat of his skin. His face was rutted, cracked like old stream beds. I kept waiting for him to speak some ordinary thing, to offer thanks, ask a question. Somewhere in her palace, my sister was laughing. "You have been tame your whole life, and now you'll be sorry." "Yes, father, yes, father. See what it gets you." My tongue touched my lips. "Is there?" The man threw me back against the wall. My head hit the uneven stone, and the room sparked. I opened my mouth to cry out the spell, but he jammed his arm against my windpipe and the sound was choked off. I could not speak. I could not breathe. I fought him, but he was stronger than I had thought he would be, or maybe I was weaker. The sudden weight of him shocked me, the greasy push of his skin on mine. My mind was still scrambled, disbelieving. With his right hand, he tore my clothes. A practiced gesture. With his left, he kept his weight against my throat. I had said there was no one on the island, but he had learned not to take chances. Or perhaps he just didn't like screaming. I don't know what his men did. Watched, maybe. If my lion had been there, she would have clawed down the door, but she was ash upon the winds. Outside, I heard the pigs squealing. I remember what I thought, bare against the grinding stone. I am only a nymph, after all, for nothing is more common among us than this. A mortal would have fainted, but I was awake for every moment. At last, I felt the man tremble, and his arm loosened. My throat was crushed inward like a rotted log. I could not seem to move. A drop of sweat fell from his hair onto my bare chest and began to slide. I became aware of his men speaking behind him. "Is she dead?" one of them was saying. "She better not be dead. It's my turn." A face loomed over the captain's shoulder. "Her eyes are open." The captain stepped back and spat at the floor. The jellied glob quivered on the stone. The drop of sweat slid onwards, carving its slimy furrow. A sow shrieked in the yard. Convulsively, I swallowed. My throat clicked. I felt a space open in me. The sleep spell I had been going to say was gone, dried up. I could not have cast it even if I wanted to. But I did not want to. My eyes lifted to his rutted face. Those herbs had another use, and I knew what it was. I drew breath and spoke my word. His eyes were muddy and uncomprehending. "What?" He did not finish. His ribcage cracked and began to bulge. I had the sound of flesh rupturing wetly, the pops of breaking bone. His nose ballooned from his face and his legs shriveled like a fly sucked by a spider. He fell to all fours. He screamed, and his men screamed with him. It went on for a long time. As it turned out, I did kill pigs that night, after all.